time to welcome once again a woman from outer space. Well, she's not from outer space. She's actually in Christchurch. But she's the co-founder of Space Base, one of the New Zealand space companies based in Canterbury, Emmeline Part-Dahlstrom. Kia ora, Emmeline. Welcome back to Nights.
Kia ora. Thanks for having me again.
It's nice to have you on. You want to talk about the moon, going back to the moon. We've been talking about this ever since, what, 1972, going back to the moon?
Yeah, I was born during the Apollo moon program. So certainly pretty exciting times, but I think it's even more exciting this time around. In the past, it was more of a, you know, it was a race just between the US and Russia. This time, we're calling it the Artemis program, and it's really more of an international effort that's happening. And yeah, there's essentially there's different parts here. There's the precursor missions and robotic missions that are going to kind of like scout out what's happening. And then there's also the human side where we want to go back to the moon. And the motivations are different now. The motivations really are more, besides science exploration, it's also there's commercial as well, and potentially also resources. And so it's now an international effort.
Before we talk about the how and who, I am interested in the why we would do this again. What are the commercial reasons? Let's start with those that might lead to us going back to the moon again.
The moon is really the gateway to everywhere, or basically the gateway to the solar system. And today we're looking at not just going there to, you know, plant flags, but to actually stay, settle, potentially kind of like mine resources as well, and then make it a staging point for going elsewhere, like Mars and the asteroids.
Why is the moon a better gateway to the rest of the solar system, the rest of space? I can understand why the Earth wouldn't be ideal, because the Earth's so big and you need so much energy to get out of its orbit. But the moon,
yeah,
it's still a relatively large body. Why not just a space station orbiting Earth?
The moon, at least, is a smaller body. There's also less gravity, so which means you can actually, land and also take off much easier. And then also, as part of the Artemis program, one of the first things that they're actually doing is creating what they call the lunar gateway, which in a sense, it's a space station on lunar orbit. So now that we have the ISS that is orbiting around the Earth, what they want to do is a station that will orbit the moon, which would be kind of like a staging place for either construction, science, also for understanding how we could potentially be living elsewhere, but not so far that we're kind of like we're still very much within the Earth lunar kind of ecosystem.
What about resources on the moon that we might like to exploit? Does the moon have anything that's useful to us?
Essentially, you know, they found water on the moon a couple of years ago, and water is a great resource because you can also create rocket fuel out of water. And they definitely know now that there is water at the poles. So sometimes people say that the kind of like the best real estate in the solar system is actually a very, very small area around the South Pole of the moon, which is actually called Shackleton Crater. And the reason why it's the best like real estate is because there's water in the craters that has actually not seen daylight for millions, billions of years. But at the same time, because of the way that the moon is angled, it's almost like there's always perpetual sunlight in that area. So just imagine if you are going to actually mine or settle there, you would need energy all the time. And so if you're in an area that has perpetual sunlight, you can get basically solar energy for the entire time that you're there, and you can use that energy to get the water resources that are near there. So most countries right now, and even some of the commercial companies that are looking at the moon, they're all looking at that particular area to basically go.
Well, because you've got part of the area is always in perpetual darkness, but not far afield is part of the moon which is in perpetual light. Am I understanding that right? It's not
correct.
The opposite pole.
Yes,
it's
yes.
Actually the same. Yes. The same bottom bit of the moon.
Yeah. So yeah. You got both. Where yeah, the area that you want to be in is should be in perpetual sunlight. Almost perpetual sunlight to get your energy, and then the part that is in perpetual darkness is where the supply of water is.
Because I'm guessing if sunlight falls on that ice, which is what it'll be, then that water will become gas pretty much straight away, and off she goes into space, right?
Yep. That the physics definitely yes.
Is there anything else on the moon, any minerals that might be useful for us back on Earth?
There's a company here in New Zealand that wants to use kind of lunar regolith to actually create solar cells so that you don't have to carry all of those materials to the moon to create your kind of your energy sources. I mean, that's one thing. The other thing as well is that there's another company here called Aspiring Materials that is working on extraterrestrial cement, which would be also on a critical path for these things that we're talking about, because you actually need landing pads on the moon so that whoever kind of like, you know, whoever lands beside you doesn't get pummeled by the debris that would basically go up when you land something on the moon, which is something that people are not really thinking about. And so you need some landing pads. And if you can create lunar cement, that's certainly one thing that would be an important thing to have. And that, there's a company here in New Zealand that's sort of like working on that.
What about tourism?
Yeah, the last time we talked about tourism as well. There are companies, you know, like SpaceX right now, who's working on the Starship, which is also looking at doing flybys of the moon. So they're not yet looking at landing on the moon, but there is already a billionaire, a Japanese billionaire, who's actually paid for a flight to go on a flyby on the moon. There's also Space Adventures, which is another company that has been sending private citizens to the International Space Station like for 20 years now. They also have, or they are selling tickets to do flybys, although the hardware for that through the Russians actually hasn't been developed yet.
Let's talk about the who's doing this and the how. You've been mentioning the Artemis program. Who's behind that?
The Artemis program is really the name is just like what we call Apollo before. So now it's called the Artemis program, and the Artemis program has, like as I mentioned, two parts. There's those that are basically working on robotic missions, so lunar landers and rovers. And today there's what we call the CLIPS program, which is really NASA sending, you know, 2 to 3 missions to the moon every year. And these are precursor missions, meaning they're science missions to stake out what should be the missions for the humans, like afterwards.
They'll be robotic missions.
Correct. Yeah. And so those are happening right now. There's about 14 companies that NASA has basically picked to potentially to bid on those missions. That includes, you know, SpaceX and Blue Origin, the ones that are that you kind of like know, including Boeing and Lockheed. And there's another company called Cirrus Robotics that I'm actually affiliated with, and that's also one of those companies, a startup company that is working on landers and rovers. So that's one part. The other part is really the kind of the human missions. So just like we had Apollo, the lunar landers and orbiters in the past, there is also what we call the space launch systems that is building the rocket that will bring another spacecraft, a human rated spacecraft, that will then first go on a flyby to the moon. And then it will potentially land on the moon. And what's interesting about this is that the timeline, they think, or at least the original schedule was that they think they can land by 2024. That's not that far from where we are now.
Landing humans on the moon again in 2024.
Correct. We don't know if that's actually going to happen. And basically in the past, it's all NASA and contracting, you know, companies in the U.S. This time around, it's actually basically contracted commercial companies and then also included international partners. So, for example, the service module that is part of that spacecraft that is going to go to the moon is being developed by the European Space Agency. And there's more than half a dozen countries that are working on like the components for this. And today they're already training astronauts for these missions. I'm really kind of like hoping to see who that those are, because the first kind of like woman who is going to step on the moon is actually in training now. I mean, we don't know exactly who would be the first, but there's certainly training. So those are the two things. Now for the human missions, basically the very first one as part of that mission is they need to kind of like scope out, right, where they're going. And the first thing that they need to do is really to build what we were talking about earlier, which is the gateway, the space station on the moon. And to be able to do that, you need the precursor, basically mission, to see which orbit that station should be placed. And this is what they call the capstone mission. And what is interesting about this one is that it's actually going to be launched from New Zealand around March of 2022. I know it was supposed to be at the end of this year, but I think because of COVID and so forth, the schedule got moved. But the spacecraft, which is US built by another startup company, is basically going to be launched from Mahia Peninsula by an Electron rocket. And it's riding on a Photon Rocket Lab rocket that will then go beyond Earth orbit and be propelled to the moon.
Would it have a landing module?
Really,
would it have a landing module which will land on the moon's surface?
No. So this one is going on a it's a mouthful. It's a near rectilinear halo orbit, NRHO. So the reason for this is that it needs to go on an orbit, which is going to be the orbit where that station is going to be in the future. And the uniqueness of this orbit is that it needs to see the Earth always while it's orbiting the moon, so that the communications will always be, there's no blackout in the communications. So that's the first,
right.
That's the first mission.
This is a mission, what, to as a precursor to the International Moon Station you were talking about earlier, is it, Emmeline?
Correct.
Are all these things managed, coordinated by NASA?
Well, they're certainly the kind of like the lead on this, and they're putting the biggest sort of like resources on it. But at the same time, there's a lot of countries that are actually part of it. So, for example, Australia has pledged like $150 million to be part of the program. The Japanese has put in like 472 million. There's others from South Korea to Canada. So it is an international effort.
Are there any other countries which are coordinating their own? Because NASA's a US. For example, yes. Is China coordinating its own completely separate moon program or Russia?
Yes, actually. My understanding is that there was just a recent announcement that China and Russia are actually collaborating together on a lunar mission. I don't know what the specifics of that is, but yeah, so that's certainly another program.
So whatever's happening, it's likely to just be Artemis, NASA, and the Lunar Gateway. There's going to be at least one other, perhaps a Sino-Russian effort as well, and that makes it into a race again, doesn't it?
Well, I think there's a component of, maybe there's a component of that, but I think the motivations are really different now. I actually think that there is going to be a huge lunar economy that's going to happen.
So here's one last question then, Emily, and that is, you were talking about the best real estate maybe in the solar system being at the south pole of the moon, where there is water, and also there's not too far from where that ice is. There is a part of the moon in near perpetual daylight. Now, is that likely to be privately owned? Can you envisage private property on the moon? In fact, is that necessary in order for there to be investment in the moon?
That's a really great question. Just to kind of like preface it, basically today we've got the Outer Space Treaty where nobody can own anything basically in space. And that's been signed by 130 countries. There's the Moon Treaty that's been signed by 11 countries where you can't own and you can't also mine or take resources. It's definitely not something that is possible to do today in terms of like owning real estate. However, there's something called the Artemis Accord that was recently also signed by a number of countries, including New Zealand. And the Artemis Accord, basically, the most important thing there, it's got a lot of provisions from, you know, peaceful uses of space to basically sharing of data to helping people with emergency assistance. But the most important thing here is that in terms of the space resources, it's just like the rules of the sea where you can actually fish, but and take the fish with you, but you don't own the area where you're fishing. So it's the same way on the moon. You can mine for resources, but you don't own the land.
Okay, but you could own the resource. You could own the water.
You can own the resources.
The ice,
that's sort of,
and yeah. Then make a lot of money from that ice, right? And do you think, Emily, the thing is that there'll be people listening who'll be thinking, this is horrific. I thought space was going to be like Antarctica, where everyone, all humans, work together. Private property means there'll be commercial interests competing. But the alternative argument is that you need private property in order for people to be willing to invest in operations which, for example, might mine ice from the moon, which would then be used to make rocket fuel.
So I guess the I think that the argument is a little different, because you if you can actually mine and you can get resources, then you can still you can still commercialize and get revenue from it without owning the real estate, and I think that's where the money is going to come from.
But you are going to be owning the resource, and that's the question I'm asking. Yeah. You've got some privatization, yes, going on, haven't you?
Yes, because you are owning the resources.
And do you think that's important? Is that something which is necessary if we're going to get commercial companies saying, right, I'm going to invest what will be billions of dollars in a venture, which hopefully will, at the end of the road, give me and my shareholders a return on investment, that being money that will be made from the extraction of water and manufacture of hydrogen fuel, most likely from that water?
For commercial purposes, yes. I mean, it definitely is important. Now, however, just also pointing out that the Artemis Accord was signed by nation states. So there is a big question mark here about what the commercial companies are going to do. And again, that is definitely a big question.
How far away are these decisions, these issues? Next decade?
Well, I really hope that it's going to be in this decade because, the issue here is, I think, the policy and regulations are lagging behind the appetite of the commercial companies for opening up this cislunar economy. And so, therefore, we definitely need to have the regulations and policies in place because we don't want to have the same thing that we're kind of like grappling with, the same social problems that we have back on Earth happen kind of on a much bigger scale. So that's certainly something that I'm really worried about.
Emmeline, it's been fascinating talking with you again. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.